already we can see this huge collapse in business, you know, in the informal economy. You know, the textiles trade, the weaving, the saris that the Indian women wear are all made in the handicraft sector. Millions of people are employed in it, and all the transactions are in cash. Now, without cash, they've all been jobless for 2 months.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com in a conversation being recorded on the 20th of January, 2017. And if you are following The Corbett Report, you will remember from late last year, on November 8th, to be precise, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi made a dramatic announcement live on television that as of 12 midnight that evening, the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes would no longer be accepted as legal tender in the country, and that in a process over the next couple of months, all citizens would have to turn in those notes and exchange them for new ones, newly minted by the government. A dramatic announcement that has had pretty dramatic effects already on the Indian economy, let alone what is to come in the months and years to follow. And I did start documenting some of that in my article for the International Forecaster, Crisitunity in India's Cash Crunch, talking about some of the reasons why the Indian government might have wanted to do this. But in order to get into more depth, let's talk to someone in India about this. Today we're going to be talking to Satya Sagar, who writes at countercurrents.org. And I'm going to be directing you to a couple of different articles that he's written on this subject. One that I found on Kafila Online, Death by Demonetization, published on November 17th of last year, and one that was published on Global Research just last week, India's Caste System, Social Inequality and Demonetization. Thank you for joining us today on The Corbett Report.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Satya, let's discuss this this whole topic of demonetization. But for those of us who aren't in India and don't know the economic context of India, tell us, what is the importance of the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, and how common are cash transactions in India?
Well, bulk of the transactions in India, monetary transactions, are with cash. The figure is around 98% before demonetization. After demonetization, it might have gone down to, say, 95%, not more than that. So very, very small number of people actually transact digitally, but in terms of value, it might be more. I mean, because the volumes of volume and the value are different. So cash transactions would account for still something like, say, 90%. So 10% would be digital. Of these 98% or 90 to 98% of transactions in cash, more than 50% are very small value transactions. Because of the very large size of the Indian informal sector, which again is 90%, 92%. You know? So the formal sector, where people have regular salaries, bank accounts, money coming into the salary, coming into the accounts and so on, accounts for only 7 or 8% of the Indian economy. And bulk of the people of India work in the informal sector. So it's a move by the Indian government which has affected a very vast majority of Indians directly and immediately.
So, of course, combating the black money in the informal sector was one of the reasons specifically cited for this demonetization. But in your Death by Demonetization article, you talk about four different benefits that this gives to the Indian government: rebooting troubled Indian banks, increasing the government's cash flow, boosting the digital cash economy, and cutting political opponents down to size. Can you walk us through those different reasons that this has actually taken place?
First, I would like to explain a little bit about this whole terminology of black and white money. Apart from being racist, and the assumption that black is bad and white is good, the problem is that money doesn't come in just black and white. It comes in many colors: red, yellow, green, purple, because it all depends on what the money is being used for and how it is used and who got it, when, where. So it's a much more complex kind of situation. Just to give you an example, what is popularly referred to as black money in India is money that is either untaxed, because people have not shown it in their books or records and paid tax on it, so they're hiding that money. That's black money, according to the mainstream terminology. The other one is corruption money, which is people taking bribes, you know, typically government officials, or a politician getting bribed. So this money is again unaccounted for. So broadly, it refers to unaccounted money, which is an illegality. You know, it's an illegal transaction. But here I would like to point the attention of your audience to a very simple fact that a lot of what passes off as white money is not necessarily very legal either. I'll give you a very simple example. The richest man in India is somebody called Mukesh Ambani of Reliance Industries. He figures in the top 20, 30 billionaires in the world. And his father, who made the original fortune back in the 90s and all, he imported an entire NAFTA-producing plant into Bombay in the mid-90s from abroad. I mean, it was a second-hand plant from, I don't know exactly where, but it's a whole factory that's supposed to make NAFTA. The import duties on importing such equipment was very high. So what got done was that the week in which the machinery arrived in Bombay port, the government of India lowered the import tariffs just for exactly 1 week so that his plant could come in at lower import duties, and then they raised it up again. So this is white. I mean, it's completely illegal. There's not a single law that's been broken. But I'm just giving an example, drastic one. But this happens again and again, where people who have political influence, and politicians today themselves are businessmen, or very closely tied to businesses, they keep tweaking the law so that they are always on the right side of the law. So all the money that they have is white money. They're not breaking any laws. But the laws are breaking the economy. You know, the laws are breaking the interests of the rest of the country. So as a result, today we have, just to give you a bit of context of India, is that new report coming out in the last couple of years, Credit Suisse Capital has produced a wealth report in which they point out 1% of the Indian population owns close to 60% of the economy or the GDP. Just 57 families in India own 60 to 68% of all the wealth. So this is the kind of terrible inequality. So when we talk about the informal sector, you really talk about people who survive on something like anywhere between $2 to $10 a day, you know, or $20 a day at the most. Of course, you have a section of trading communities, and they would constitute a kind of middle class. They earn better, and they also have a lot of unaccounted cash, because taxation, the idea of taxation is important in any modern society, because it's supposed to be meant to be revenues that the government spends back on public welfare. But here, the state of infrastructure, state of health, state of education, roads, energy, transport is so abysmal, nobody wants to give any money to the government, and also because of the high levels of corruption. Now, the demonetization decree that was sprung as a surprise on the Indian public on the 8th of November was meant ostensibly to be a war on A, this unaccounted money, B, on counterfeit notes that was supposed to be circulating in the Indian economy, and it was supposed to be used by terrorists, and it was supposed to increase the revenues for the government, because the more number of people who come on digital transactions, the more tax they will have to pay, because it will be accounted for and it could be tracked. Now, the problem with this is very simply that cash as overall percentage of black money in India is estimated to be only 6%, because nobody keeps it in cash. The guys who are having all this unaccounted money, they put it away in property, gold, or keep it abroad in foreign accounts. So it's only 6%. So you're really attacking the smallest part of the bigger problem. So it was a very dishonest move to begin with. Second is that a lot of the black money is used in political electoral campaigns and so on and so forth. The political parties are the biggest conduit for black money, because any donation given to a political party is untaxed. So they can accept as much as they want. There are some rules, but those rules are easily broken. So if the government had been really honest about wanting to hit black money, they would have started with the political parties, starting with the ruling political party itself. Now, having set that aside as an argument, the real reason seems to be that the Indian economy at the moment, you know, in the last 20 years, the fastest growing companies worldwide and in India also have been telecom companies. if I was an entrepreneur with the vision to see telecom as a big business 25 years ago, I would be multi-billionaire today. Now, digital economy is the way to go globally. I mean, everywhere there's a huge shift happening to digital transactions, you know, e-wallets and payment gateways and payment banks. You know, software is taking over the world, literally speaking, everywhere. So here there are a bunch of players who are looking ahead and saying, hey, I want to be there in 5 years' time. So I'm going to invest in a way and set up all the right investments so that I'm positioned to take advantage of the boom in the digital economy. The only problem for them was that there was no boom. So they got the government to produce a boom. So it's literally like that. It's like, reminds me of some of the stories from the Latin American dictatorships back in the 60s and 70s, where a dictator would sort of ban people from wearing slippers because he owned a shoe factory. So it's one of those things. It's straight out of, you know, people like Suharto and Pol Pot and Gaddafi and stuff like that. The other excuse that they had was that the Indian banks, many of which are public sector banks, 80% of the banking system is public sector, government-owned banks. These have been misused over the last 25 years to give out loans to politically connected businesses who have no intention of returning this money. As a result of which, you have a huge overhang of what are called non-performing assets. Now, banks are virtually on the verge of collapse, literally speaking, in some ways. And the warning signals have been coming for the last 2-3 years. So the government has tried to kill several birds with the same stone, help their friends, you know, take advantage of the new boom in digital business, refinance the banks by getting everybody, the poorest people in the country, to put in their $2, $20 into the bank, millions of them doing it. You refinance the banks, clean up their accounts, so that they can restart lending to the same guys who didn't return the loans that they took earlier. It's almost like it's a joke, literally speaking, you know. And the other objective that they seem to have is electoral politics. As I mentioned, a lot of cash is involved. So there are big elections coming up in some of the provinces in India in the next couple of months. So the ruling party has an advantage as an insider information that this move is going to come. So they keep their money more safely so that it doesn't get confiscated or it doesn't get hit by the compulsory demonetization or the need to deposit it into the banking system. So they have a big cash advantage because they've got new currency notes. The operators have got old notes which they don't know what to do with.
Now, you've already touched on this, but let's drill down into that issue about the social and wealth inequality that's at the root of all of this. The people who will be most affected by this are the poorest people in India. And in your article on India's caste system, you write, "From all evidence so far, it is clear that the scheduled castes and scheduled tribes who make up a bulk of those surviving off India's vast informal economy are the worst affected by the sudden disappearance of cash from the economy. Labor in agriculture, construction, fishing, textiles, micro-enterprises, the urban and rural poor, mostly from these marginalized castes, have been pushed to the brink of starvation or worse due to loss of jobs and income." Let's talk about that issue and how this affects the poorest people in India.
Just to again give some context, if you looked at India just the hour before this demonetization was announced, what was the situation? You have a country of 1.2 billion people, the second largest population in the world. And in terms of the sheer numbers of absolute people in absolute poverty, 9 Indian provinces account for more number of people in absolute poverty than the 24 sub-Saharan African countries put together. So you're talking about a staggering scale of people in absolute poverty defined as less than $2 a day of income. You have the world's largest burden of disease. We are number one in tuberculosis, we are number one in malaria, we are number one in, not in HIV, but diarrhea, deaths due to diarrhea, deaths of children dying due to pneumonia, it goes on. Malnutrition, 45 to 47% of the Indian adult population has stunted growth. You know, 55% of children have stunted growth. So you're talking about the whole population out there which never had anything to begin with. I mean, these are people who didn't have cash and they're being asked to go cashless. It's a bit of a joke, you know. So you had a very drastic situation. Now, if you disaggregate this broad numbers on poverty, you'll find that it's certain communities in India who figure again and again in these statistics more prominently. The scheduled castes are the people who in the Indian caste system are right at the bottom. They do the menial work, they do the dirty, dangerous kind of work in the rural economy for a long time. But over the years, they have gravitated to the lowest rung of jobs in the urban and industrial economy also. Then you have the scheduled tribes, who are basically indigenous people who live in the forests, in the hills, along the coast. These people are even more marginalized, but they don't suffer the consequence of the caste system directly because they're actually outside it in many ways. But over the years, the Indian economic model, which is imitating models elsewhere, has taken over land, forests, water, resources belonging to the indigenous people. To give an example of the 70 to 80 million people displaced due to large development projects since Indian independence in 1947, something like 40 to 45 million people are from the indigenous community. So they constitute 10% of the Indian population, but in terms of displacement due to government or other projects, they constitute 70-75%. So it's a very sort of terrible situation they were already in. Now, these are people who don't have literacy, they don't have access to infrastructure, even simple energy like electricity. And they are supposed to now cope with a digital economy where you need to have a smartphone, you need to have access to internet, you need to have access to a laptop or whatever. You need to be able to negotiate the banking system, which is complicated for them. I mean, in typical Indian bank, if you walk into it, even as an educated person, you know, it's a matter of quite some time before you can get your money out, you know. You fill out a couple of forms, stand in a queue, explain why you need the money and blah, blah, blah. It goes on, you know. For a very poor, illiterate person, and it's also this caste divide comes up because bank employees and anybody in a secure job in India typically would be from one of the better off castes. And if you're somebody from the lower caste walking into these offices, you're basically right from the beginning an unwanted person, by and large. You know? People don't go to health services in India. Government run health services exist on paper, they exist on ground also. But the very poor and from the lower caste don't go there because they're humiliated. The same with the banking system. So now the impact of demonetization is going to be, already we can see this huge collapse in business and in the informal economy. You know, the textiles trade, the weaving, the saris that the Indian women wear are all made in the handicraft sector. Millions of people are employed in it and all the transactions are in cash. There's a whole chain of people supplying things, people doing the stitching and the weaving and the embroidery, people supplying raw materials. Now, without cash, they've all been jobless for 2 months. You know, agriculture, farmers have to employ agriculture labor. Agriculture labor is typically scheduled caste or scheduled tribe. They can't pay cash anymore. Builders can't pay cash to construction workers. So there's a mass kind of impact already as we go along in the next few months. In fact, the parallel to what's happening in India, you have to go back to the 19th century when the East India Company was ruling India and where they brought in new rules from the top, which benefited their attempts to increase tax revenue or make things orderly or manageable from their perspective, European perspective. But it caused tremendous amount of damage. They also tampered with currencies, for example. They tampered with property laws. The consequence of that in the 19th century was massive displacements. And one of the more tragic consequences was something called the Bengal famine in the mid-19th century. There's one more in the early part of the 20th century. But millions just died of starvation. Today, we have no idea because the data is not there. The government is the only agency which is capable of collecting data on such a large scale, and they will not collect it. But anecdotal evidence suggests that typically, a lot of people who are virtually just barely managing to eat 2 meals a day will cut back their meals to 1 a day, and those who are eating 1 will eat none. And in this story, one must not forget, there's a lot of discrimination against the female child. So ultimately, there's a girl child out there somewhere who's going to be denied food because somebody wants to go digital. You know? And it's a crazy thing. But you know, these are all poor people who really didn't figure in anybody's calculations. They don't exist unless they die in large numbers, let me put it this way.
Yeah, and even then, maybe if those large numbers can be swept under the rug, maybe they'll try to do so. That's really the question here. There's no doubt the poorest people in India are paying an economic price for this already and will continue to do so. But will Modi and his party pay a political price for this? Is there any suggestion that they may actually be worse off because of their actions?
It's not clear immediately. You see, it's difficult for people, even very educated people, don't understand how money and currency and wealth really work. I mean, that's why, I mean, I cannot imagine any other reason why, again, you could look at the global figures of 8 people owning 50% of the globe's wealth. This is an Oxfam report that came out a couple of days ago. You know, I mean, even in the West today, we're highly educated people, politically conscious. Inequality has become such a glaring problem, you know. I mean, more so in the US than in Europe, but still it's there. You know? And so we're talking about the phenomenon of money is a very abstract thing. Nobody understands how exactly it works. And those who do understand and can manipulate it, they manage to accumulate way more than they should be accumulating. Now, in a country like India, for ordinary people, even in the middle classes, educated middle class, to figure out whether this is a good or bad move, depends on how hard it hits them. A lot of people in India, it's a low consumption economy even today. Though it's supposed to be growing very rapidly and so on and so forth. It's still a low consumption economy. You know? The average Indian consumes a very tiny portion of the energy consumed by a European or an American or a Japanese. You know? So they're capable of putting up with much more. You know, if you take winter in Delhi, it's 3 degrees or 2 degrees. But there are no central heating in any of the homes. Even the rich don't have central heating. You know? They have heaters, but not central heating. So they can put up with much more. So there's going to be a period where people are just going to wait and watch. People who have been affected the most, the poor, are voiceless, they're unorganized. So it will take some time for them to come out and express it. And even then, what might happen, and interestingly enough, I'm in Chennai right now, and as we speak, there is this massive outpouring of public protest against a ban on a traditional sport in which a bull is tamed by barehanded village youth. You know, it's a very old sport, but there are these animal rights activists sitting in New Delhi who have gone to court and the court has banned the sport. So right now, as we speak, there are 30 to 40,000 people out there protesting. They've been doing it for the last 4 days. Now, this is something to do with the pride, Tamil pride, and protecting culture and tradition. But I suspect it's much more than that. People don't come out on the streets against demonetization, but they'll find every other excuse to come out. You know, it gets goes at a tangent sometimes. So there'll be a lot more discontent, absolutely. The problem with the ruling party, whether it will really lose or it's certainly not going to benefit from this, but it may maintain its status for some time. Part of the problem is that the parties that ruled the country before this, they were not much better. I mean, 20 years ago, the Indian economy opened up, and that was done by the opposition party, the party which is in opposition right now. And they didn't care about the poor either. In the last 20 years, we have seen inequality grow. So this party, which is in power, has actually continued, though they came to power opposing the previous policies. Once in power, they've continued similar kind of policies. The reason is today it doesn't matter in many of our countries, particularly in the developing countries, I suspect in the developed world also, it doesn't matter who's elected to power. There are bigger powers who are unelected, who control vast amounts of capital, who get their way anyway, because the sums of money you're talking about are simply mind-boggling. Just to give a small figure, the Indian economy, the GDP is 2.5 trillion, roughly, dollars annually. That's the amount of financial transactions that take place in the city of London, the financial city of London, in one day. You know, so the entire economy of India for a year, 1.25 billion people, is equal to one day's transaction in London. So, I mean, you're talking about scales of difference where the Indian economy just doesn't matter. And if I'm an Indian prime minister, at some stage, the temptation to do according to where the big money is so much, I'm going to brush aside even my own traditional base of support Because everybody thinks, and this is a common thinking, that people think that once I have the money, then I can do exactly what I really want to do, you know, whatever it is. It never happens, we know that. You chase the money, and this is what is happening. This Prime Minister and right now, he came to power by whipping up a lot of sentiment of protecting tradition, religion, conservative kind of agenda against the economic policies of the previous government. And his support base was unemployed youth in urban areas, aspirational kind of classes who didn't get a share of the benefits from the liberalization policies 20 years ago. But he's betrayed all of them. He's just betrayed all of them. And there are job losses happening right now. But he's thinking probably that once this mess is over and I get all the money that the big corporates are going to give me to win the next election, then I will do something for these people. It's never going to happen.
No. Sadly, I think that's something that all the Corbett Report listeners, wherever they are in the world, can understand all too well, that it is always a power behind the throne that is more important than the power in office. And the thing that I can relate to personally is there's no central heating here in Japan either, so it's quite cold here in the middle of winter, so I can relate to that. But obviously, a terrible situation, and one that is going to continue unfolding from here. For people around the world who are interested in this subject, but don't want to hear about the propaganda from the mainstream news sources about this, where can they go for real information about what's happening in India?
Countercurrents.org I would recommend, not because I write for it, because they're a very eclectic website who have a very good range of subjects that they touch upon. Because very often what happens is that people write about one subject as if it is unrelated to everything else. You know, you write on the economy, you write only on the economy, you write on politics as if it's not linked to culture or sport or whatever. In Countercurrents, you get a much wider flavor, international and national both. I'm talking about non-mainstream sources of information. Though on the demonetization issue, there's been good reportage, I must say, in the Indian, not totally mainstream, but say somewhere between the very alternative and very mainstream. There's something called the Wire.in. The Wire.in. That's another good website. You have the Economic and Political Weekly, which has a website, but I think you need to be a subscriber to log on to that. They have more in-depth research kind of articles. India is a complex country to understand. I dare say that not many Indians understand it either. It's too vast, and everybody grows up in a country like everywhere else thinking that their experiences are the framework from which they need to judge, but actually it's not true. There are multiple universes, multiple eras coexisting in India, you know, and it takes quite some time to figure out what's happening. And then you have all these, like for example, this ban on the traditional sport that I was talking about, protests are happening right now. Well-meaning animal rights activists think that these bulls, which are being tamed, is done with bare hands. The bulls are not killed. It's not the Spanish bullfight. It's much less violent than that. But still, the bull is sort of made to get agitated, and it runs around a field, and there's 20 youth with bare hands who try to wrestle it down to the ground. Now, this is part of a very ancient sport, 2,000 years plus. You know, the bull that is not tamed or untamable goes on to become the champion bull, which will be used for breeding new stock. You know? So it's linked to the farming practices, you know. And it's also a sport entertainment at one level. Now, very well-meaning, I can imagine very well-meaning people for ethical treatment of animals. Activists have gone to court saying that this is a cruelty to animals and so on and so forth. And the court has agreed. But the court is very remote from where all this sport is happening. It's happening in the interiors of Tamil Nadu, which is in the south of India. Then nobody's bothered to go to these people and say, hey, why are you doing this? Can we do it differently? Do we really need to do it? Nobody's willing to talk to them. They want to impose something all the way from Delhi, as if we still were in the times of the Mughal Empire, you know, or the British Empire for that matter. So you issue a decree of some kind and expect people to change behavior, and constantly people are being messed with. The human being is a biological creature who's grown up in a particular ecosystem. He's like a plant and an animal cross between a plant and an animal. It takes a long time for culture to develop. Right or wrong is a different issue, but these bad things also take a long time to come, and good things also take a long time to come, because we are like an ecosystem, we are organic creatures. And here comes this engineering guy who says, I want everything changed to pronto, now. You know, so you, everybody goes digital tomorrow morning. Everybody has to start behaving like this. You know, even something like gender equality in a country like India will take a long time to come. It's coming. You cannot force it on people. It will never work. And the revolt will take place in a way that will make things much worse. You know, it's somewhat the debate is really about similar to what the West, Western liberals, for example, had debate about whether to bomb Saddam Hussein or not, or bomb Gaddafi, or bomb the Taliban. There's an opinion which says, no, we can't stand by and watch while these guys are oppressing their women. So actually, then you go in and bomb everybody, including those oppressed women. I mean, there's a problem there. You know, you can't.
And then the real jihadis get into power and oppress the women even further. So, yeah, it's unintended consequences are always there.
No, there is this engineering versus agricultural principles. I would put it like this. Engineering is in a hurry. You know, if people want to change things immediately, even well-intentioned, but it causes, it's a root of violence where you're simply not able to wait, be patient, change things according to the pace of the people whose lives are being changed. You want everything now and you're in a hurry. And also this idea of endless growth, the idea of endless abundance or whatever, you know, this was the central problem that which the Soviets had, which is why communism collapsed, because they made the wrong promises, basically, you know, which they couldn't deliver on. And the West is also trapped in that kind of similar kind of thing, though the West, because of larger democratic institutions and principles, it's been moderated much more. It was moderated. But still there, the richest man in the world is still trying to make money. I can't believe this. You know, what the hell is going to do with that money? I mean, I'm not saying he gives some to me, but I'm saying that he can do a hell of a lot of nice things with it. You know, and that is the model everybody is following, and it's causing so much of unhappiness. It's unbelievable. Because I would question the idea of poverty itself. You know, people have lived the way they've lived for 10,000 years in the forests of, say, central India. They don't think of themselves as poor. All that needs to be done is that they need to be left alone. You can't have a mining company go and displace all of them, you know, uproot their forests, deprive them of the resources that they are used to, dump them in an urban slum, and ask them to get educated. You know, education has become this grand kind of catch-all thing where, you know, first you do injustice to somebody and then say, get educated and you might get a good job. You know, it's ridiculous. Why the hell should anybody learn mathematics when I'm perfectly happy, you know, living off this forest for centuries? You know, so there is a central problem we are dealing with, I guess, in many parts of the world. I think somewhere before it all ends up in ecological or, you know, other kinds of disaster, you will need to step back and reflect a little more on who the human being is. Is there something called a human being at all? Is it just a fancy term for something that's a cross between a plant and an animal? We evolved out of, you know, different species, and maybe we should pay a little more attention to that.
Exactly. Well, are we just robots to be engineered by central organizers who want to tell us not only what is wealth and what is poverty, but how that wealth has to be transferred around and in what format and in what way?
Yeah, exactly. So, it's basically, you know, constantly imposing new rules. I mean, take in India, for example, if you take the scheduled caste community, thanks to affirmative action, they've got access to some education, some jobs. It's in the last 40, 50 years, slowly some of them have clawed their way up into better economic situation. The children are getting educated. But now we change the rules of the game. It's like I thought that playing, say, football was the way to go. And I spent a lifetime learning the rules, playing well. And one morning I'm told, no, football is not the game to play. It's lawn tennis or, you know, hockey or something like that. And I'm just, you know, slide back to where I was, like a game of snakes and ladders that's been played around.
Very, very true. Well, Satyasagar, a fascinating conversation. So much here that I think people need to get caught up to speed on. So I will direct them again to those articles I mentioned and to countercurrents.org. I'll put the links to all of these things in the show notes so people can check them out for themselves. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
I don't know if you've seen it. It's actually a satire. The Indian Prime Minister, in some of the context, said that we need more humor and satire. So I wrote a piece where 2 years after demonetization, the Indian government, realizing that the move has not worked very well, they go for another surgical strike. This time they ask Indian citizens to deposit all their black hair.
Yeah, I haven't seen that economy. Yet. But I will check that out. I'll put that in the show notes as well.
The play on words, actually, the cashless in Hindi, the dominant language in India, the word for hair is cash. So from cashless, it becomes cashless economy.
Very funny. All right, I'll check that out and I will put that in the links. Satya Sagar, thank you again for your time today. The Federal Reserve, the heart of the American banking system. For over 100 years, it has operated in the shadows, controlling America's money supply in total secrecy.
So all that information is available in our commercial paper
program. And who got the money?
Hundreds and hundreds of banks, any bank or that has access to the U.S. Federal Reserve's discount.
They tell us who they are.
No.
Until now.
100 years ago, in 1913, the Fed was created.
Fractional reserve banking.
The legal authority to do it.
Takeover of monetary policy.
Are conducted by the Federal Reserve Banks. They are banks.
There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
Century of Enslavement, the history of the Federal Reserve. Watch the documentary for free at corbettreport.com/Federal Reserve. And purchase a copy on DVD to help support the Corbett Report today.